5. Practically bounding from my bed to the sounds of bustling and carousing outside, I went to the window and looked out over the town. It seemed all the lights of Miracle were shining, save in that section down the hill which became part of the black void of winter. And now the town's greenish tinge was even more pronounced, spreading everywhere like a great green rainbow that had melted from the sky and endured, phosphorescent, into the night. In the streets was the brightness of an artificial spring. The byways of Miracle vibrated with activity. On a nearby corner, a brass band blared. Marauding cars blew their horns and were sometimes mounted by laughing pedestrians. A man emerged from the Red Rooster bar, threw up his arms, and crowed. I looked closely at the individual celebrants, searching for the vestments of clowns. Soon, delightedly, I saw them. The costume was red and white, with matching cap, and the face painted a noble alabaster. It almost seemed to be a clownish incarnation of that white-bearded and black-booted Christmas fool. This particular fool, however, was not receiving the affection and respect usually accorded to a Santa Claus. My poor fellow clown was in the middle of a circle of revelers who were pushing him back and forth from one to the other. The object of this abuse seemed to accept it somewhat willingly, but this little game nevertheless appeared to have humiliation as its purpose. "Only clowns here are the ones that are picked out," echoed Beetle's voice in my memory. "Picked on" seemed closer to the truth. Packing myself in some heavy clothes, I went out into the green, gleaming streets. Not far from the hotel, I was stumbled into by a character with a wide blue and red grin and bright, baggy clothes. Actually, he had been shoved in my direction by some young men outside a drugstore. He lost his footing on the slick sidewalk and tumbled down into a bank of snow along the street.
"See the freak?" said an obese and drunken fellow. "See the freak fall!"
My first response was anger, and then fear as I saw two others flanking the fat drunk. They walked toward me, and I tensed myself for a confrontation.
"This is a disgrace,"
one said, the neck of a wine bottle held loosely in his left hand. But it was not to me they were speaking. It was to the clown. His three persecutors helped him up with a sudden jerk and then splashed wine in his face. They ignored me altogether.
"Let him loose," the fat one said. "Crawl away, freak. Oh, he flies."
The clown trotted off, becoming lost in the throng. "Wait a minute," I said to the rowdy trio, who had started lumbering away. I quickly decided that it would probably be futile to ask them to explain what I had just witnessed, especially amid the noise and confusion of the festivities. In my best jovial fashion, I proposed we all go someplace where I could buy them each a drink. They had no objection, and in a short while we were all squeezed around a table in the Red Rooster. Soon after we were served, I told them that I was from out of town and asked if they could explain some things I did not understand about their festival.
"I don't think there's anything to understand," the fat one said. "It's just what you see."
I asked him about the people dressed as clowns.
"Them? They're the freaks. It's their turn this year. Everyone takes their turn. Next year it might be mine."
"Or yours," he said, pointing at one of his friends across the table. "And when we find out which one you are..."
"You're not smart enough," said the defiant potential freak.
This was an important point. The fact that individuals who played the clowns remained, or at least attempted to remain, anonymous. This arrangement would help remove inhibitions a resident of Miracaw might have about abusing his own neighbor or even a family relation. From what I later observed, the extent of this abuse did not go beyond a kind of playful roughhousing. And even so, it was only the occasional group of rowdies who actually took advantage of this aspect of the festival, the majority of the citizens very much content to stay on the sidelines. As far as being able to illuminate the meaning of this custom, my three young friends were quite useless. To them, it was just amusement, as I imagine it was to the majority of Miracavians. This was understandable. I suppose the average person would not be able to explain exactly how the profoundly familiar Christmas holiday came to be celebrated in its present form. I left the bar alone and not unaffected by the drinks I had consumed there. Outside, the general merrymaking continued. Loud music emanated from several quarters. Miracaw had fully transformed itself from a sedate small town to an enclave of Saturnalia within the dark immensity of a winter night. But Saturn is also the planetary symbol of melancholy and sterility, a clash of opposites contained within that single word. And as I wandered half-drunkenly down the street, I discovered that there was a conflict within the winter festival itself. This discovery indeed appeared to be that secret key which Thos withheld in his study of the town. Oddly enough, it was through my unfamiliarity with the outward nature of the festival that I came to know its true nature. I was mingling with the crowd on the street, warmly enjoying the confusion around me, when I saw a strangely designed creature lingering on the corner up ahead. It was one of the Miracaw clowns. Its clothes were shabby and nondescript, almost in the style of a tramp-type clown, but not humorously exaggerated enough. The face, though, made up for the lackluster costume. I had never seen such a strange conception for a clown's countenance. The figure stood beneath a dim streetlight, and when it turned its head my way, I felt a sense of recognition. The thin, smooth, and pale head, the wide eyes, the oval-shaped features resembling nothing so much as the skull-faced, screaming creature in that famous painting. Memory fails me. This clownish imitation rivaled the original in summoning an effect of stricken horror and despair. It had an inhuman likeness more proper to something under the earth than upon it. From the first moment I saw this creature, I thought of those inhabitants of the ghetto down the hill. There was the same nauseating passivity and languor in its bearing. Perhaps if I had not been drinking earlier, I would not have been bold enough to take the action I did. I decided to join in one of the upstanding traditions of the winter festival, for it annoyed me to see this morbid impostor of a clown standing up. When I reached the corner, I laughingly pushed myself into the creature, whoops, who stumbled backward and ended up on the sidewalk. I laughed again and looked around for approval from my fellow merrymakers in the vicinity. No one, however, seemed to appreciate or even acknowledge what I had done. They did not laugh with me or point with amusement, but only passed by, perhaps walking a little faster until they were some distance from this street corner incident. I realized instantly I had violated some tacit rule of behavior,
though I had thought my action well within the common practice. The idea occurred to me that I might even be apprehended and prosecuted for what in any other circumstances was certainly a criminal act. I turned around to help the clown back to his feet, hoping to somehow redeem my offense, but the creature was gone. Solemnly, I walked away from the scene of my inadvertent crime and sought other streets away from its witnesses. Along the various back avenues of Miracaw, I wandered, pausing exhaustedly at one point to sit at the counter of a small sandwich shop that was packed with customers. I ordered a cup of coffee to revive my inebriated system. Warming my hands around the cup and sipping slowly from it, I watched the people outside as they passed the front window. It was well after midnight, but the thick flow of passers-by gave no indication that anyone was going home early. A carnival of profiles filed past the window, and I was content simply to sit back and observe, until finally one of these faces made me start. It was that frightful little clown I had roughed up earlier. But although its face was familiar in its ghastly aspect, there was something different about it, and I wondered that there should be two hideous freaks. Quickly paying the man at the counter, I dashed out to get a second glimpse of the clown, who was now nowhere to be seen. I wondered how it could have made its way so easily out of sight, unless the dense crowd along the sidewalk had instinctively allowed this creature to pass unhindered through its massive ranks, as it did for Thos. In the process of searching for this particular freak, I discovered that interspersed among the celebrating populace of Miracaw, which included the sanctioned festival clowns, there was not one or two, but a considerable number of these pale, wraith-like creatures, and they all drifted along the streets unmolested by even the rowdiest of revelers. I now understood one of the taboos of the festival. These other clowns were not to be disturbed, and should even be avoided, much as were the residents of the slum at the edge of town. Nevertheless, I felt instinctively that the two groups of clowns were somehow identified with each other, even if the ghetto clowns were not welcome at Miracaw's winter festival. Indeed, they might legitimately be regarded as part of the community and celebrating the season in their own way. To all appearances, this group of melancholy mummers constituted nothing less than an entirely independent festival, a festival within a festival. Returning to my room, I entered my suppositions into the journal I was keeping for this venture. The following are excerpts. There is a superstitiousness displayed by the residents of Miracaw with regard to these people from the slum section, particularly as they lately appear in those dreadful faces signifying their own festival. What is the relationship between these simultaneous celebrations? Did one precede the other? If so, which? My opinion at this point, and I claim no conclusiveness for it, is that Miracaw's winter festival is the later manifestation, that it appeared after the festival of those depressingly pallid clowns, in order to cover it up or mitigate its effect. The holiday suicides come to mind, and the subclimate Thos wrote about, as well as the disappearance of Elizabeth Beadle 20 years ago. And my encounter this very day with the pariah clan existing outside, yet within the community. Of my own experience with this emotionally deleterious subseason, I would rather not speak at this time. Still not able to say whether or not my usual winter melancholy is the cause,
On the subject of mental health, I must consider Thos's book about his stay in a psychiatric hospital in Western Massachusetts. Almost sure of that. Check on this book and Miracaw's New England roots. The winter solstice is tomorrow, albeit sometime past midnight. It is, of course, the day of the year on which night hours surpass daylight hours by the greatest margin. Note what this has to do with the suicides and a rise in psychic disorder. Recalling Thos's list of documented suicides in his article, there seemed to be a recurrence of specific family names, as there very likely might be for any kind of data collected in a small town. Among these names was a beadle or two. Perhaps then there is a hereditary basis for the suicides, which has nothing to do with Thos's mystical subclimate, which is a colorful idea to be sure, and one that seems fitting for this town of various outward and inward aspects, but is not a conception that can be substantiated. One thing that seems certain, however, is the division of Miracaw into two very distinct types of citizenry, resulting in two festivals and the appearance of similar clowns, a term now used in an extremely loose sense. But there is a connection, and I believe I have some idea of what it is. I said before that the normal residents of the town regard those from the ghetto, and especially their clown figures, with superstition. Yet it's more than that. There is fear, perhaps hatred, the particular kind of hatred resulting from some powerful and irrational memory. What threatens Miracaw, I think I can very well understand. I recall the incident earlier today in that vacant diner. Vacant is the appropriate word here. The congregation of that half-lit room formed less a presence than an absence, even considering the oppressive number of them. Those eyes that did not or could not focus on anything, the pining lassitude of their faces, the lazy march of their feet. I was spiritually drained when I ran out of there. I then understood why these people and their activities are avoided. I cannot question the wisdom of those ancestral Merocavians who began the tradition of the winter festival and gave the town a pretext for celebration and social intercourse at a time when the consequences of brooding isolation are most severe, those longest and darkest days of the solstice. A mood of Christmas joviality obviously would not be sufficient to counter the menace of this season. But even so, there are still the suicides of individuals who are somehow cut off, I imagine, from the vitalizing activities of the festival. It is the nature of this insidious subseason that seems to determine the outward forms of Miracaw's winter festival, the optimistic greenery in a period of gray dormancy, the fertile promise of the winter queen, and most interesting to my mind, the clowns, the bright clowns of Miracaw who are treated so badly. They appear to serve as surrogate figures for those dark-eyed mummers of the slums. Since the latter are feared for some power or influence they possess, they may still be symbolically confronted and conquered through their counterparts, who are elected for precisely this function. If I am right about this, I wonder to what extent there is a conscious awareness among the town's populace of this indirect show of aggression. Those three young men I spoke with tonight did not seem to possess much insight beyond seeing that there was a certain amount of robust fun in the festival's tradition. For that matter, How much awareness is there on the other side of these two antagonistic festivals? Too horrible to think of such a thing, but I must wonder if, for all their apparent aimlessness, those inhabitants of the ghetto are not the only ones who know what they are about. No denying that behind those inhumanly limp expressions, there seems to be a kind of obnoxious intelligence. As I wobbled from street tonight, watching those oval-mouthed clowns, I could not help feeling that all the merrymaking in Miracle was somehow allowed only by their sufferance. This, I hope, is no more than a fanciful Thossian intuition, the sort of idea that is curious and thought-provoking without ever seeming to gain the benefit of confirmation. I know my mind is not entirely lucid, but I feel that it may be possible to penetrate Miracle's many complexities and illuminate the hidden side of the festival season. In particular, I must look for the significance of the other festival. Is it also some kind of fertility celebration? From what I have seen, the tenor of this celebrating subgroup is one of anti-fertility, if anything. How have they managed to keep from dying out completely over the years? How do they maintain their numbers? But I was too tired to formulate any more of my sodden speculations. Falling onto my bed, I soon became lost in dreams of streets and faces. 6. I was, of course, slightly hungover when I woke up late the next morning. The festival was still going strong, and blaring music outside roused me from a nightmare. It was a parade. A number of floats preceded downtown's end, a familiar color predominating. There were theme floats of pilgrims and Indians, cowboys and Indians, and clowns of an orthodox type. In the middle of it all was the Winter Queen herself, freezing atop an icy throne. She waved in all directions. I even imagined she waved up at my dark window. In the first few groggy moments of wakefulness, I had no sympathy with my excitation of the previous night, but I discovered that my former enthusiasm had merely lain dormant and soon returned with an even greater intensity. Never before had my mind and senses been so active during this usually inert time of year. At home, I would have been playing lugubrious old records and looking out the window quite a bit. I was terribly grateful, in a completely abstract way, for my commitment to a meaningful mania. And I was eager to get to work after I had had some breakfast at the coffee shop. When I got back to my room, I discovered the door was unlocked, and there was something written on the dresser mirror. The writing was red and greasy, as if done with a clown's makeup pencil. My own, I realized. I read the legend, or rather I should say riddle, several times. What buries itself before it is dead? I looked at it for quite a while, very shaken at how vulnerable my holiday fortifications were. Was this supposed to be a warning of some kind? A threat to the effect that if I persisted in a certain course, I would end up prematurely interred? I would have to be careful, I told myself. My resolution was to let nothing deter me from the inspired strategy I had conceived for myself. I wiped the mirror clean, for it was now needed for other purposes. I spent the rest of the day devising a very special costume and the appropriate face to go with it. I easily shabbied up my overcoat with a torn pocket or two and a complete set of stains. Combined with blue jeans and a pair of rather scuffed-up shoes, I had a passable costume for a derelict. The face, however, was more difficult, for I had to experiment from memory. Conjuring a mental image of the shrieking Pierrot in that painting, the scream, I now recall, helped me quite a bit. At nightfall, I exited the hotel by the back stairway. It was strange to walk down the crowded street in this gruesome disguise. Though I thought I would feel conspicuous, the actual experience was very close, I imagined, to one of complete invisibility. No one looked at me as I strolled by, or as they strolled by, or as we strolled by each other. I was a phantom, perhaps the ghost of festivals past, or those yet to come. I had no clear idea where my disguise would take me that night, only vague expectations of gaining the confidence of my fellow specters and possibly in some way coming to know their secrets. For a while, I would simply wander around in that lackadaisical manner I had learned from them, following their lead in any way they might indicate. And for the most part, this meant doing almost nothing and doing it silently. If I passed one of my kind on the sidewalk, there was no speaking, no exchange of knowing looks, no recognition at all that I was aware of. We were there on the streets of Miracaw to create a presence and nothing more. At least, this is how I came to feel about it. As I drifted along with my bodiless invisibility, I felt myself more and more becoming an empty, floating shape, seeing without being seen, and walking without the interference of those grosser creatures who shared my world. It was not an experience completely without interest and even enjoyment. The clown's shibboleth of "Here we are again" took on a new meaning for me as I felt myself a novitiate of a more rarefied order of harlequinry. And very soon the opportunity to make further progress along this path presented itself. Going the opposite direction, down the street, a pickup truck slowly passed, gently parting a sea of zigging and zagging celebrants. The cargo in the back of this truck was curious, for it was made up entirely of my fellow sectarians. At the end of the block, the truck stopped, and another of them boarded it over the back gate. One block down, I saw still another get on. Then the truck made a U-turn at an intersection and headed in my direction. I stood at the curb, as I had seen the others do. I was not sure the truck would pick me up, thinking that somehow they knew I was an imposter. The truck did, however, slow down, almost coming to a stop when it reached me. The others were crowded on the floor of the truck bed. Most of them were just staring at nothing with the usual indifference I had come to expect from their kind. But a few actually glanced at me with some anticipation. For a second I hesitated, not sure I wanted to pursue this ruse any further. At the last moment, though, some impulse sent me climbing up the back of the truck and squeezing myself in among the others. There were only a few more to pick up before the truck headed for the outskirts of Miracaw and beyond. At first, I tried to maintain a clear orientation with respect to the town, but as we took turn after turn through the darkness of narrow country roads, I found myself unable to preserve any sense of direction. The majority of the others in the back of the truck exhibited no apparent awareness of their fellow passengers. Guardedly, I looked from face to ghostly face. A few of them spoke in short, whispered phrases to others close by. I could not make out what they were saying, but the tone of their voices was one of innocent normalcy, as if they were not of the hardened slum herd of Miracle. Perhaps, I thought, these were thrill-seekers who had disguised themselves as I had done, or more likely, initiates of some kind. Possibly they had received prior instructions at such meetings as I had stumbled onto the day before. It was also likely that among this crew were those very boys I had frightened into a precipitate exit from that old diner. The truck was now speeding along a fairly open stretch of country, heading toward those higher hills that surrounded the now distant town of Miracle. The icy wind whipped around us, and I could not keep myself from trembling with cold. This definitely betrayed me as one of the newcomers among the group, for the two bodies that pressed against mine were rigidly still and even seemed to be radiating a frigidity of their own. I glanced ahead at the darkness into which we were rapidly progressing. We had left all open country behind us now, and the road was enclosed by thick woods. The mass of bodies in the truck leaned into one another as we began traveling up a steep incline. Above us, at the top of the hill, were lights shining somewhere within the woods. When the road leveled off, the truck made an abrupt turn, steering into what looked like a great ditch. There was an unpaved path, however, upon which the truck proceeded toward the glowing in the near distance. This glowing became brighter and sharper as we approached it, flickering upon the trees and revealing stark detail where there had formerly been only smooth darkness. As the truck pulled into a clearing and came to a stop, I saw a loose assembly of figures, many of which held lanterns that beamed with a dazzling and frosty light. I stood up in the back of the truck to onboard as the others were doing. Glancing around from that height, I saw approximately 30 more of those cadaverous clowns milling about. One of my fellow passengers spied me lingering in the truck and in a strangely high-pitched whisper told me to hurry, explaining something about the apex of darkness. I thought again about this solstice night. It was technically the longest period of darkness of the year, even if not by a very significant margin from many other winter nights. Its true significance, though, was related to considerations having little to do with either statistics or the calendar. I went over to the place where the others were forming into a tighter crowd, which betrayed a sense of expectancy in the subtle gestures and expressions of its individual members. Glances were now exchanged. The hand of one lightly touched the shoulder of another, and a pair of circled eyes gazed over to where two figures were setting their lanterns on the ground about 6 feet apart. The illuminations of these lanterns revealed an opening in the earth. Eventually, the awareness of everyone was focused on this roundish pit, and as if by prearranged signal, we all began huddling around it. The only sounds were those of the wind and our own movements as we crushed frozen leaves and sticks underfoot. Finally, when we had all surrounded this gaping hole, the first one jumped in, leaving our sight for a moment, but then reappearing to take hold of a lantern which another handed him from above. The miniature abyss filled with light, and I could see it was no more than 6 feet deep. One of its walls opened into the mouth of a tunnel. The figure holding the lantern stooped a little and disappeared into the passage. Each of us, in turn, dropped into the darkness of this pit, and every fifth one took a lantern. I kept to the back of the group, for whatever subterranean activities were going to take place, I was sure I wanted to be on their periphery. When only about 10 of us remained on the ground above, I maneuvered to let 4 of them precede me so that I might receive a lantern. This was exactly how it worked out, for after I had leaped to the bottom of the hole, a light was ritually handed down to me. Turning about face, I quickly entered the passageway. At that point, I shook so with cold that I was neither curious nor afraid, grateful for the shelter. I entered a long, gently sloping tunnel, just high enough for me to stand upright. It was considerably warmer down there than outside in the cold darkness of the woods. After a few moments, I had sufficiently thawed out so that my concerns shifted from those of physical comfort to a sudden and justified preoccupation with my survival. As I walked, I held my lantern close to the sides of the tunnel. They were relatively smooth, as if the passage had not been made by manual digging, but had been burrowed by something which left behind a clue to its dimensions in the tunnel's size and shape. This delirious idea came to me when I recalled the message that had been left on my hotel room mirror. What buries itself before it is dead? I had to hurry along to keep up with those uncanny spelunkers who preceded me. The lanterns ahead bobbed with every step of their bearers, the lumbering procession seeming less and less real the farther we marched into that snug little tunnel. At some point, I noticed the line ahead of me growing shorter. The processioners were emptying out into a cavernous chamber where I too soon arrived. This area was about 30 feet in height, its other dimensions approximating those of a large ballroom. Gazing into the distance above made me uncomfortably aware of how far we had descended into the earth. Unlike the smooth sides of the tunnel, the walls of this cavern looked jagged and irregular, as though they had been gnawed at. The earth had been removed, I assumed, either through the tunnel from which we had emerged, or else by way of one of the many other black openings that I saw around the edges of the chamber, for possibly they too led back to the surface. But the structure of this chamber occupied my mind a great deal less than did its occupants. There to meet us on the floor of the great cavern was what must have been the entire slum population of Miracaw and more, all with the same eerily wide-eyed and oval-mouthed faces. They formed a circle around an altar-like object which had some kind of dark, leathery covering draped over it. Upon the altar, another covering of the same material concealed a lumpy form beneath. And behind this form, looking down upon the altar, was the only figure whose face was not greased with makeup. He wore a long, snowy robe that was the same color as the wispy hair berimming his head. His arms were calmly at his sides. He made no movement. The man I once believed would penetrate great secrets stood before us with the same professorial bearing that had impressed me so many years ago. Yet now I felt nothing but dread at the thought of what revelations lay pocketed within the abysmal folds of his magisterial attire. Had I really come here to challenge such a formidable figure? The name by which I knew him seemed itself insufficient to designate one of his stature. Rather, I should name him by his other incarnations. God of all wisdom, scribe of all sacred books,
father of all magicians, thrice great and more. Rather, I should call him Thoth.
He raised his cupped hands to his congregation, and the ceremony was underway. It was all very simple. The entire assembly, which had remained speechless until this moment, broke into the most horrendous, high-pitched singing that can be imagined. It was a choir of sorrow, lament, and mortification. The cavern rang with the dissonant, whining chorus. My voice, too, was added to the congregations, trying to blend with their maimed music. But my singing could not imitate theirs, having a huskiness at odds with the keening ululation of that company. To keep from exposing myself as an intruder, I continued to mouth their words without sound. These words were a revelation of the moody malignancy, which until then I had no more than sensed whenever in the presence of these figures. They were singing to the unborn in paradise, to the pure unlived lives. They sang a dirge for existence, for all its vital forms and seasons. Their ideal was a melancholy half-existence, consecrated to all the many shapes of death and dissolution. A sea of thin, bloodless faces trembled and screamed their antipathy to being itself. And the robed, guiding figure at the heart of all this, elevated over the course of 20 years to the status of high priest, was the man from whom I had taken so many of my own life's principles. It would be useless to describe what I felt at that moment, and a waste of the time I need to describe the events which followed. The singing abruptly stopped, and the towering white-haired figure began to speak. He was welcoming those of the new generation. 20 winters had passed since the pure ones had expanded their ranks. The word pure in this setting was a violence to what sense and composure I still retained, for nothing could have been more foul than what was to come. Thoth, and I employ this defunct identity only as a convenience, closed his sermon and drew closer to the dark-skinned altar. Then, with all the flourish of his former life, he drew back the topmost covering. Beneath it was a limp-limbed effigy, a collapsed puppet sprawled upon the slab. I was standing toward the rear of the congregation and attempted to keep as close to the exit passage as I could. Thus, I did not see everything as clearly as I might have. Thoth looked down upon the crooked, doll-like form and then out at the gathering. I even imagined that he made knowing eye contact with me. He spread his arms and a stream of continuous and unintelligible words flowed from his moaning mouth. The congregation began to stir, not greatly, but perceptibly. Until that moment, there was a limit to what I believed was the evil of these people. They were, after all, only that. They were merely morbid souls with beliefs that were eccentric to the healthy social order around them. If there was anything I had learned in all my years as an anthropologist, it was that the world is infinitely rich in phenomena that society as we know it, whoever we might be, would regard as strange, even to the point where the concept of strangeness itself had little meaning for me. But with the scene I then witnessed,
My conscience vaulted into a realm from which it will never return. For now was the transformation scene, the culmination of every harlequinade. It began slowly. There was increasing movement among those on the far side of the chamber from where I stood. Someone had fallen to the floor, and the others in the area backed away. The voice at the altar continued its chanting. I tried to gain a better view, but there were too many of them around me. Through the mass of obstructing bodies, I caught only glimpses of what was taking place. The one who had swooned to the floor of the chamber seemed to be losing all former shape and proportion. I thought it was a clown's trick. They were clowns, were they not? I myself could make four white balls transform into four black balls as I juggled them. And this was not my most astonishing feat of clownish magic. And is there not always a sleight of hand inherent in all ceremonies, often dependent on the transported delusions of the celebrants? This was a good show, I thought, and giggled to myself. The transformation scene of Harlequin throwing off his fool's facade. Oh God, Harlequin, do not move like that. Harlequin, where are your arms? And your legs have melted together and begun squirming upon the floor. What horrible, mouthing umbilicus is that where your face should be? What is it that buries itself before it is dead? The almighty serpent of wisdom, the conqueror worm. It now started happening all around the chamber. Individual members of the congregation would gaze emptily, caught for a moment in a frozen trance, and then collapse to the floor to begin the sickening metamorphosis. This happened with ever-increasing frequency the louder and more frantically Thos chanted his insane prayer or curse. Then there began a writhing movement toward the altar, and Thos welcomed the things as they curled their way to the altar top. I knew now what lax figure lay upon it. This was Cora and Persephone, the daughter of Ceres and the Winter Queen. The child abducted into the underworld of death. Except this child had no supernatural mother to save her, no living mother at all. For the sacrifice I witnessed was an echo of one that had occurred 20 years before, the carnival feast of the preceding generation. O carne vale! Now, both mother and daughter had become victims of this subterranean sabbat. I finally realized this truth when the figure stirred upon the altar, lifted its head of icy beauty, and screamed at the sight of mute mouths closing around her. I ran from the chamber into the tunnel. There was nothing else that could be done, I have obsessively told myself. Some of the others who had not yet changed began to pursue me. They would have caught up to me, I have no doubt, for I fell only a few yards into the passage. And for a moment, I imagined that I, too, was about to undergo a transformation. Anything seemed possible now. When I heard the approaching footsteps of my pursuers, I was sure there was nothing left for me but the worst finale a human being can suffer, the death known to those whom the gods have first made mad. Perhaps I would even be forced to take a place on the altar among the gory remnants of the Winter Queen. but the footsteps behind me ceased and retreated. They had received an order in the voice of their high priest. I too heard the order, though I wish I had not. For until then I had imagined that Thos did not remember who I was. It was that voice which taught me otherwise. For the moment I was free to leave. I struggled to my feet and, having broken my lantern in the fall, retraced my way back through cloacal blackness. Everything seemed to happen very quickly once I emerged from the tunnel and climbed up from the pit. I wiped the reeking grease paint from my face as I ran through the woods and back to the road. A passing car stopped, though I gave it no other choice except to run me down. "Thank you for stopping."
"What the hell are you doing out here?" the driver asked.
I caught my breath. "It was a joke. The festival. Friends thought it would be funny. Please, drive on." My ride led me off about a mile out of town, and from there I could find my way. It was the same route I traveled when I first visited Miracle the summer before. I stood for a while at the summit of that high hill, just outside the city limits, looking down upon the busy little hamlet. The intensity of the festival had not abated. I walked toward the welcoming glow of green and slipped through the festivities unnoticed. When I reached the hotel, I was glad to see that no one was about. Given that I was so obviously a wreck, I feared meeting anyone who might ask what had happened to me. The hotel desk was unattended, so I was spared having to speak with Beadle. Indeed, there was an atmosphere of abandonment throughout the place that I found ominous, yet did not pause to contemplate. I trod up the stairs to my room. Locking the door behind me, I then collapsed upon the bed and was soon enshrouded by a merciful blackness. 7. When I awoke the next morning, I saw from my window that the town and surrounding countryside had been visited during the night by a heavy snowfall, one which was entirely unpredicted. A few leftover flakes were still lighting on the now deserted streets of Miracle, and buried beneath the drifts below were the last vestiges of revelry and celebration. The festival was over. Everyone had returned to their homes. And this was exactly my own intention. Any action on my part concerning what I had seen the night before would have to wait until I was away from the town. I am still not sure it will do the slightest good to speak up like this. Any accusations I have made with respect to the slum populace of Miracle are eminently subject to dismissal, perhaps as a hoax or a festival hallucination. And thereafter, this document will take its place alongside the works of Raymond Thos. With packed suitcases in both hands, I walked up to the front desk to check out. The man behind the desk was not Samuel Beadle, and he had to fumble around to find my bill.
"Here we are. Everything all right?"
"Fine," I answered in a dead voice. "Is Mr. Beadle around?"
"No, I'm afraid he's not back yet. Been out all night looking for his daughter. She's a very popular girl, being the Winter Queen and all that nonsense. Probably find she was at a party somewhere." A little noise came out of my throat. I threw my suitcases in the back seat of my car and got behind the wheel. On that morning, nothing I could recall seemed real to me. The snow was falling and I watched it through my windshield, slow and silent and entrancing. I started up my car, routinely glancing in my rear view mirror.
What I saw there is now vividly framed in my mind, as it was framed in the back window of my car when I turned to verify its reality. In the middle of the street behind me, standing ankle-deep in snow, were Thos and another figure. When I looked closely at the other, I recognized him as one of the boys whom I surprised in that diner. But he had now taken on a listless resemblance to his new family. Both he and Thos stared at me, making no attempt to forestall my departure. Thos knew that this was unnecessary. I had to carry the image of those two dark figures in my mind as I drove back home, and only now has the full gravity of my experience descended upon me. So far I have claimed illness in order to avoid my teaching schedule, to face the normal flow of life as I had formerly known it would be impossible. I am now very much under the influence of a season and a climate far colder and more barren than all the winters in human memory. And mentally retracing past events does not seem to have helped. If anything, I now feel myself sinking deeper into a velvety white abyss. At certain times, I could almost dissolve entirely into this inner realm of purity and emptiness, the paradise of the unborn. I remember how I was momentarily overtaken by a feeling I had never known when in disguise I drifted through the streets of Miracaw, untouched by the drunken, noisy forms around me. Untouchable. It was the feeling that I had been liberated from the weight of life. But I recoil at this seductive nostalgia, for it mocks my existence as mere foolery, a bright clown's mask behind which I have sought to hide my darkness. I realize what is happening and what I do not want to be true, though Thos proclaimed it was. I recall his command to those others as I lay helplessly prone in the tunnel. They could have apprehended me, but Thos, my old master, called them back. His voice echoed throughout that cavern, and it now reverberates within the psychic chambers of my memory. "He is one of us," it said. "He has always been one of us." It is this voice which now fills my dreams and my days and my long winter nights. "I have seen you, Dr. Thos, through the snow outside my window. Soon I will celebrate, alone, that last feast which will kill your words, only to prove how well I have learned their truth." To the memory of H.P. Lovecraft.